This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Join Sonia for a very special interview.
Hi, Quentin Tarantino. I'm Sonia from Sci-Fi and Squim on Joy 94.9. And just want to congratulate you on The Hateful Eight.
Oh, what a nice thing to say. Thank you, Sonia.
Looks like Minna's haberdasher is about to get cosy for the next few days.
Yes, it does.
Music for myself with the passing of the great David Bowie.
Yeah.
You used an Inglourious Basterds, the Cat People soundtrack.
Absolutely, yeah.
Would it be your favourite song?
Oh, the song of his?
Tune in to Sci-Fi and Squeam for Sonia Meets Tarantino on Joy 94.9.
Get in, boy!
What make a man brave a blizzard, kill in cold blood? I'm sure I don't know. You'd be surprised what a man would do.
You starting to see pictures, ain't you?
Got room for one more?
I ain't too anxious to be handing out rides.
Real trusting fella, huh?
Not so much.
Ain't no way I'm spending a couple of nights under a roof with somebody I don't know who they are. So who are you?
Okay, everybody, hear this. I'm taking this woman to hang.
Rewards?
$10,000. That money's mine, boys.
Oh, that's interesting.
I don't drink with rebel renegades, and I damn sure don't break bread with them.
Well, Mr. Roof.
What up, boy?
You sound like you got an axe to grind against the cause.
God, yeah. Renegade army. Bunch of losers gone loco, you bet I do. Yeah. Wrapped yourselves up in a rebel flag as an excuse to kill and steal. This ought to interest you, Warren, in particular emancipated blacks.
Sounds like my kind of fella.
Sound to me you've been reading a lot of newspapers printed in Washington, D.C. Anywho, I'm just trying to let y'all know how grateful I am. I was a goner, and y'all saved me.
You want to show me how grateful you are? Shut up.
Me and one of them fellows is in cahoots. We're just waiting for everybody to go to sleep. That's what we're gonna kill you.
Let's slow it down. Let's slow it way down.
Get to hell. Tell him Daisy sent you.
Come on, go! You don't die now!
No one said this job's supposed to be easy.
Nobody said it's supposed to be that hard, neither.
I give you, he got guts. But in the brains department, you're like a man who took a high dive in a low well. Sounds like my kind of fella.
Listen for a moment, lads, and hear me tell my tale. All the sea from England, sure I was condemned to sail. Sentence you across the stormy sea.
Oh, cool. I had to take some cat fur off it, but it's
okay.
Not allergic. We're all ready to go. Cool. Hi, Quentin Tarantino. I'm Sonia from Sci-Fi and Squim on Joy 94.9. And I just want to congratulate you on The Hateful Eight.
Oh, what a nice thing to say. Thank you, Sonia.
Wonderful film. Very good. But I wanted to ask a question, of course, about the role of women in your films, and in particular The Hateful Eight.
Yeah, sure.
Is the main, one of the main protagonists, of course, is the wonderful Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. Which is great. Mm-hmm. And as Daisy. And the importance, what is the importance of having, in this case, just one female this time in the film?
Oh, well, you know, that's interesting. Interesting the way you pose that. You know, it's interesting because when I first came up with the idea, I just thought it was, well, especially when I first came up with the idea, I didn't really know 100% where the story was going. Mm-hmm. I had a really good idea about what's going on in the stagecoach. But exactly what they'd find when they got to Minnie's haberdashery, which is where they end up, and who would be there, and exactly how everything would fall out, I didn't quite know. So it was like the first chapter led to the second chapter, which led to everything else. So I just kind of started off with the idea of this brutal bounty hunter with a female prisoner in tow, and then the and then a black bounty hunter coming on board, and then just letting them kind of hash it out. And I actually thought a female prisoner could be a very interesting dynamic, you know, to the piece, especially as the other male characters kind of gathered around her and stuff. But as I was going on, I wanted to make it, I didn't want to, she is a woman, and absolutely, and I even like the idea that, you know, she's smaller. She's actually a petite woman. All right, that wasn't what I wrote, but I liked it in the course of the movie. I like the fact that she's a petite woman. I like the fact the other male characters are stronger than her. Ooh, you know, she can't, you know, really fight back in that regard. She is stuck in that scenario. She only has her wits to go with on her as far as that was concerned. At the same time, I didn't want to treat her like a lady. I didn't want, and I don't, all right, I didn't want to make any concessions to her as a female character. If it hadn't have been Daisy Domergue, if the character had been a character named Big Bill Shelley and he was 300 pounds, nothing in the scenario would have changed. Nothing in the dynamic would have changed per se to it, but it did make it more interesting and provocative and maybe even painful, all right, and provocative that it was a woman in that role instead.
Mm. Well, when you see her getting violence against her, it's shocking in the first chapter.
Yeah, especially especially in that, you know, especially that first one.
Yes.
When the first one happens, there's meant to be a ripple through the audience. But, you know, part of that ripple is supposed to be, is like, oh man, that John Ruth is a brutal bastard.
Yes.
Well, he is.
Doing his job.
Yeah.
Yep. Quentin, I'm Darcy from Sin Media. It's a pleasure to meet you today.
Hey, Darcy, good to meet you.
So I saw the film recently in the old 70mm format, particularly with the old style film projectors. And as soon as it was kind of announced that you were doing it that way, I thought it's perfect because I love the old Quentin Western. So what made your decision to kind of present it in that format?
Well, it was funny because I think at the very, very initially, it was more of a personal selfish point on my part, because with digital projection taking over the way it has, I mean, there was never a question that I would shoot it on film, whether that be 35mm or what. But with digital projection taking over, I did think that, well, if I shoot it on 70, that's a more expensive format. So if the studio is going to actually pay to shoot it on 70, then they're going to make a valiant effort to have it shown in 70, at least to some degree or another, at least in some sort of a token way. But that is meaningful. Not everywhere, but to some degree. And so that kind of was my thinking initially, like when I wrote on the first page, okay, filmed in Gloria 70mm and blah, 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 blah. All right, so that was maybe the first part. However, as I explored it, I'd frankly been wanting to shoot a movie or at least blow up a print from 35 to 70 like my whole career. And now I finally had a chance to do it. But I did like the idea that it did emphasize the visual aspects of the movie, really taking advantage of the weather and the landscapes. But what ended up actually, you know, and the visual qualities of it, like i.e. the breath and everything that you see in the film. But what ended up revealing itself to me in doing it, and I mean, and this I also knew as well, but I learned it even more from doing it. Is I've always felt that while most people think of like using 70 to shoot mountain ranges or the pyramids or travelogue-y kind of things, I've always felt that the real big scope formats can bring you a deeper sense of intimacy if used the right way, you know, I think that goes without saying when it comes to the close-ups. That we get in the film. I mean, I've shot a lot of close-ups of Sam Jackson, but there was never quite as evocative as these ones here. But especially in this movie, once we get into Minnie's, and once we get into the stagecoach stopover that they're trapped in from the blizzard for the rest of the movie, is there's an aspect of paranoia going on with all the characters. And to one degree or another, they're almost like a chess game is going on. And they're the pieces, and Minnie's itself is the chessboard. And consequently, in every shot inside of there, there's always two plays going on at the same time. There's the foreground play, which is whatever the characters are dealing with dramatically at that given moment. But then there's the background play. Where are the other characters in relation to them, especially since you can't trust anybody? There's always like Joe Gage in that little corner, or Daisy and John Ruth over by the bar. And it's always very important that you, and when we flip it around, same thing. And it's always very important that you know where all the characters are in relation to each other. Nobody, unless I don't want you to, in particularly one moment in particular. So, because you're not supposed to be able to trust anybody. And everybody can see everybody else in it. And that was important that you, the viewer, be able to keep tabs on everybody as well. And that ended up being perfect for what we were trying to do.
Mm. Well, it works effectively. It is like a board game.
Yeah, it is a bit, I think.
I just have a question. The Lincoln letter that appears throughout the film sort of guides the Samuel Jackson character, of course. Is that a metaphor for yourself that you're saying about race relations in the U.S. at the moment or historically?
Well, it's one of those weird... It's one of those weird... subtext that becomes text. You know what I mean? As the story goes on. But that was an evolving thing. It was an evolving thing. I ended up writing this script differently than I've ever written another script before. Normally I write these kind of big, long novelish kind of books. And then there it is. Boom. And it's one process, and I get to the end. And then I usually, they're not like scripts. They're like books, and I'm kind of adapting them into the movie. All the time. Here, I didn't want to do that. Here, I wanted it to be more like a theater piece. And but I didn't want to. I wanted to write it three different times before I actually said it was finished. And the idea behind that was to just spend time with the material. Don't be so quick to be having it done. Don't be okay now. Just because I got to the end, that means I'm done. I wanted to have the experience of telling the story three different times, literally writing it out, as you know. Dun, 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 on a tap writer, go through that experience. And one of the aspects about that is I could explore things, but I didn't have to take them all the way to the very end. I can just explore it, touch base on it, then leave it, and then just let it sit, let myself think about it. Then I go to another draft, and then I can take it a little further. And what I mean by that is in the case of the Lincoln letter, in the very first draft, it was only brought up in the stagecoach, and that was it. Because I really wasn't ready to go forward with it yet. I wanted to sit on it. What does that mean? Well, what can I do with this? Let's not be so quick right now. Let's just let it sit. And I think that by the time I get through telling the entire story and I get ready to do it again, I'll have more ideas about that. And I even remember my agent. You know, after he read the script, he goes, you know, that Lincoln letter is a really good idea. I think you should do something more with it. And I go, oh, I intend to. I'm just kind of not ready yet. But it ended up being a very important aspect as far as, like, how Major Warren is able to negotiate his way through a hostile society that puts him apart from other people like him and puts him apart from a lot of the other white people that he deals with, because this letter gives him a sense of exceptionalism.
And protection.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it also just, like, you know, and it softens the white people around him.
Yeah, it's effective. So, Quentin, you've directed such great blockbuster movies from Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and now, of course, The Hateful Eight. I mean, your filmography list can just go on and on. Do you sit back and kind of rate where your films are at? Like, where would The Hateful Eight sit with you as one of your favorite films that you've done?
Well, it is absolutely one of my favorite movies that I've done, but that doesn't mean anything coming from me, because I love them all. You know, and, like, you know, now, least of all, would be the time for me to decide where it sits in the pecking order, I guess. I think that's more for me to retire and, like, start thinking about, like, maybe 3 or 5 years after that retirement to actually really come up with exactly where it sits. I actually believe, though, that, like, 20 years from now, I think Hateful Eight will probably be considered in my top four of my filmography. Where I feel about it right now is I actually feel it's my best script. I feel it's the best script I've ever written. And in its own way, and that this is not making it a better movie than another movie, per se. I mean, if you like Kill Bill, you like Kill Bill. If you like Pulp Fiction, you like Pulp Fiction. But in its own way, I actually think this is probably my best directing of my own material, or handling of my own material. But I actually think a lot of that just has to do with me just becoming a better director over the course of time.
And it's fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
That's great. You're working with Zoe Bell again.
Yeah, yeah.
Good to see her. She's a Kiwi, so.
Yeah.
Love her.
Thank you. No, she's wonderful. No, I love. I love working with her. She's such a wonderful presence, and especially with a movie full of so many hateful bastards.
Yeah.
All right. It's nice to have such a sunny disposition girl as her. But also, part of the thing was I knew that if I cast Zoe, she'd be able to learn how to drive a 6-horse team.
Did she?
Yeah, that's her.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's nobody else. That's her. That's why she got cast.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
This is the last one. Why don't you guys get one more question each? Okay.
I'll ask one more.
Yep.
The way you've presented The Hateful Eight is a way that I really love, not only on the 70mm and using the old style film projection, but I'm a really big theatre guy as well. And The Hateful Eight lends itself to kind of becoming like a bit of a play with the overture, the acts, and the intermission.
Uh-huh.
Would you ever consider turning this into a live play in the future? And would you bring it to Australia?
Oh, yeah. I do intend to turn it into a play. In fact, as soon as all this is said and done, I'm looking forward to sitting down and writing the play version of it. You know, the question will be, when do I do it? All right. You know, am I wrung out from the material, having spent almost 2 years on it now? Or would I write it and then, if I'm not burnt out from it, if I still have more juice for it, then maybe I would do it this next summer. We'll see. All right. Or maybe I'll write it and put it away and then do it 3 years from now when I'm a little fresher on the idea. And I'd love to take it to Australia. Hopefully it'll be so popular that it'll go on a tour and play everywhere.
I see it as a musical, actually.
Yeah.
I see sort of musical.
Part of the thing about it doing it, though, I mean, part of the reason to do it to me would be to do it completely straight. I mean, like, for instance, if I did it as a play, we would never leave Minnie's Haberdashery. And people have been saying, yeah, but you could do this. You could film this certain thing and then mess around with the stage. She goes, well, now I'm making a movie. Now I'm making some multimedia thing. I don't need to do that. I've already done it as a movie. Either it can hold itself in that one room as a theater piece, or it can't. And I think it could.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it could. Yeah. Working with Ennio Morricone, of course.
Yeah.
Wonderful. What was that like, that experience? It's been incredible.
Oh, it was actually a dream come true. Not only was that terrific, and not only was the score that came out of it so evocative, and now I can't even imagine the movie without it, which is a brand new experience for me. Frankly, one of the best parts is we got to know each other. And he has a lot of affection for me, and I have a lot of affection for him. And to have an old maestro like him, and to now be so friendly with him and have such a nice rapport with him. I've gone out to dinner with him a few times, and you know, apparently, you know, I've heard he can be a bit of a prickly pear, but he was very lovely with me. And then, like, at a certain point in time, he gets comfortable and he starts telling jokes, and it's just it's really lovely to actually have that relationship with somebody like him.
He's an absolute maestro.
Yes, he is.
And what a great teaming together. It's,
oh, well, thank you.
I'm
so
surprised
much.
It's never happened before, but
well, we've talked about it before. Yeah. You know, I've been using his music for a long time, and but this was the one. I mean, the reason this one happened, where say it didn't happen before, is I had a little voice in my ear on this movie, just a little voice in my ear saying, "This is the one to have an original score." I don't know why. There was just a little voice in my ear. And I've always felt when I hear that voice, that is my talent's way of communicating with me. So I always try to follow that voice.
And just lastly, for music, for myself, with the passing of the great David Bowie.
Yeah.
You used an Inglourious Basterds, the Cat People soundtrack.
Absolutely, I actually regret the fact that I met him once a long time ago. And always wanted to know what he thought about my use of Cat People and Inglourious Bastards, and now I'll never know now.
Damn it. Would it be your favorite?
What?
Song?
The song of his? It probably would be. It'd be a toss-up between that and Young Americans.
Awesome. Thank you.
And I'll always remember watching him on Soul Train.
First white person?
Not quite. Gino Vannelli was the first white person.
Okay. All right. Excellent.
But it was a big deal when he was on.
Well, it was the first David Bowie appearance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Love that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Yep, it's been an absolute pleasure, Quentin. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Pleasure. Thank you, Sonny.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.